Hello and welcome to the second episode of COVIDcast, a Lowy Institute pop-up podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effect of coronavirus on global and Australian politics. My name is Michael Fullilove and I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. Each week for the next few weeks, we'll talk with Institute experts about the implications of coronavirus for the world. Let me begin by mentioning quickly some of the developments we've seen in the past week. The novel coronavirus has officially been declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization. And according to the WHO, there are now a total of 125,000 reported cases of coronavirus, and there have been 4,600 deaths. This is no longer a China story or even an Asia story. It's a global story. And in fact, this morning, one of our non-resident fellows, Tom Wright, made an interesting observation on Twitter saying that coronavirus may be the first truly global moment since the Second World War, a moment that is changing the way we live, a moment in which everyone is vulnerable. Here in Australia, the Department of Health reports 126 confirmed cases of COVID-19, including the American actors Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson, who are hospitalised on the Gold Coast, and there have been 3 confirmed deaths. We now have travel restrictions to a number of countries, and this week the government announced, first of all, a $2.5 billion health plan with pop-up respiratory clinics, and yesterday the government unveiled a $17.6 billion economic stimulus package. So things are moving quickly around the world and here at home in Australia. To talk about these events, I have today with me 3 terrific Lowy Institute colleagues: Alex Oliver, our Director of Research; Hervé Lemahieu, Director of the Institute's Asian Power and Diplomacy Program; and Roland Raja, Director of our International Economy Program. Welcome, everyone. First of all, let me ask each of you just to talk quickly about, tell us your own level of corona anxiety. How are you each feeling at the moment? I might start with you, Alex.
Thank you, Michael. It's an interesting moment. It feels like it's turned a corner, and I'm certainly not panicking, but it does have an air of inevitability about it. We've moved quite quickly from attempting to contain this and stop it from either arriving in Australia or spreading much in Australia to that inevitability that it will now. It's here. It will now, and it's really going to change the rest of the year, the next few months, for its life as we know it has now changed. That's how it feels to me.
Hervé.
Yeah, I would echo that. My concerns are elevated, let's put it that way. I think that anecdotally, Tom Hanks, Hollywood's everyday man, getting this virus and getting it in Australia was a sort of tipping point in the popular imagination. This is no longer a remote virus stemming from regions that we don't perhaps all travel to in China, but a global and, in fact, a local pandemic.
Roland?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with my colleagues here that I think the anxiety for what's happening in the country and as a nation is definitely going up. You know, from a personal perspective, I suppose my own anxiety is quite low, you know, given one's own age and health. But I think we all have to think about also the fact that we don't want to be the ones as the conduit spreading this around to other more vulnerable elements of the population. So I think even for those perhaps like myself that feel like this is not a direct threat to them, it's really important to think about what's happening more broadly than that.
Right. Alex, let me ask you about the public psychology, because we know that this virus doesn't just attack the body, it attacks the body politic. And here in Australia, we've had panic buying and hoarding. We've had toilet paper gate. How would you say the virus is affecting public sentiment?
Well, this has been fascinating because, you know, Australia's reputation has actually taken a bit of a hit internationally in the last couple of months. We first had Australia's bushfires splashed all over the front pages of global newspapers. And now we have Australia's toilet paper gate response. And I was keen to find out whether this was a uniquely Australian preoccupation or whether it was happening elsewhere. And I'm pleased to report that, in fact, we are not alone, and that, in fact, It's affected a number of countries, including Hong Kong, Tokyo, the UK, the US, and Singapore. In Hong Kong, there was an armed robbery where an armed gang stole 600 rolls of toilet paper in one day. Back in mid-February, in Tokyo, stores limited sales to one pack per person back in February as well. And it seems that it sheets back to an online rumour, actually, that the raw materials for toilet paper were the same as the raw materials for face masks, and there was obviously going to be a run on face masks, therefore that has translated into some sort of toilet paper frenzy. But people are also panic buying hand sanitizer and soap. So this is a global phenomenon where it's sort of every man for himself, and we can come back to this point later, but I think it has very interesting correlations to another global phenomenon, which is that trust in government is at an all-time low.
Roland, talk to us as an economist. Tell us about how big a deal this is so far. How big a deal is coronavirus for the global economy and the Australian economy? And give us not some predictions, but a sense of where we're going directionally.
Yeah, I mean, I think clearly it's obviously a very big shock to the global economy and to the Australian economy. I think, you know, in the short term, it could be as big as the global financial crisis of 2008-09, although the longer term consequences will probably not be quite as bad. I think if we think about the global economy, global economic growth, I think at this point, based on what we've already seen happening in China and the knock-on effects of that, we're already basically looking at a global recession. The IMF would consider a global recession as growth being below 2.5% for the world. I think we're definitely looking at something lower than that at this point already. The question is how much worse things get from here. And the way I think about that is that there are basically three key variables. The first is what happens in China. China is on the road to recovery now, but it's not without risk. It may not be able to get there. There could be a risk of reinfection as China gets back to work. So there's some risk around what happens in China. The second is the global spread of the virus, particularly in Europe and America. These are the other two biggest economies in the world. So if you have a widespread infection in those two places, then suddenly you've got all three of the world's biggest economies suffering economic weakness, and certainly the trajectory in those two areas is not particularly good at this point. And the third element, of course, is the policy response, both the health policy response and the economic stimulus response. And the interesting thing here is that, of course, a health response is critical. It's critical to limiting the human and economic damage. But at a certain point, if you need to impose quite extreme measures, widespread school closures, closures of particular kinds of businesses, or maybe many businesses, eventually that's going to not only increase the economic damage, but it's also going to blunt the effectiveness of stimulus policies in combating that economic damage. You can't encourage people to go out to spend money if they're too scared and staying at home, or if they're required to stay at home because of quarantines, or if they're taken out of the workforce because they're sick, or because those businesses are shut, or because they've got to take care of kids at home. So I think it's quite a diabolical situation on many fronts.
All right, let me go to the United States. You mentioned the US response, and as you guys know, I'm a long-time America watcher. It does seem to me almost like the coronavirus is engineered to defeat Donald Trump, in the sense that it's impervious to bluster and bunkum. It requires a measured and globally coordinated response that is informed by expert advice, and it knows nothing of Twitter. And so we are in my eyes, we are seeing the president flailing somewhat. There is a sense suddenly, I think, that these times may not suit Donald Trump. I think This is very dangerous for his re-election, but more importantly, I think for all of us, he is, I think, for the first time being tested by an externally generated crisis, and he's not doing well. I mean, we are facing, as a world, we're facing a global health crisis and an economic crisis, hopefully not a financial crisis as well, and our last line of defense is Donald Trump. There's a Trump element, but of course, not all of this comes down to President Trump. And in fact, it does seem, and I'd invite anyone to comment on this, that the response of the US government and the US society seems to be quite weak. We're not seeing the tests going out as quickly as they should be and as they are in other developed countries like Australia and Canada. So Donald Trump complains about the deep state. I sometimes talk up the deep state, but this shows us that the deep state in the United States is not actually that deep. It's actually quite shallow. It's quite a decentralized state. It's an individualistic country. So far, I would say, the response both from the White House but from the broader US society is not deeply impressive. That's how I see it. What about you guys?
No, I agree. I think this is the biggest challenge confronting the United States is not externally generated. It's confronting problems that are to do with their own systems. And the testing seems to be a crucial issue here. I think the statistic is that fewer than 10,000 people in the U.S. have been tested for a country that has a population of about 327 million people. By contrast, South Korea, which is 8 times smaller than the United States, does about 20,000 tests a day. So they've done 210,000 tests in total since the outbreak of this pandemic. So, the U.S. has a problem, and I don't think Trump has recognized it. In fact, he's been finger-pointing first at China, now at Europe. And as you say, I think he's flailing.
On the other hand, the institutions, you mentioned the sort of a societal response. It seems that the institutions and civil society are actually out in front of the government, which happens in America a lot, particularly with this administration. So, for example, Hollywood, Broadway is shutting down, the NBA is cancelling a season. As you mentioned, institutions like Harvard have shut down. They do seem to be ahead of the curve.
Roland.
Yeah, I mean, I think also when you look at how this is reverberating through markets, right? This is a situation where there's a vacuum of international leadership. Markets don't like that. The virus itself is already a huge point of uncertainty. The stock markets are down 20-25% on the year. And of course, Donald Trump doesn't really measure his economic performance based on the economy, but he measures it on the stock market. So I think that's an important variable here as well. Having said that, on the politics in the United States, Trump is the master salesman. He can wriggle out of anything almost, it seems. Nothing sticks to him. And you still need to see the Democratic side, Biden or Sanders, capitalize on this as well. So I think it's definitely a blow to Trump, but it's not necessarily a death blow.
Let me say, Roland, you talked about the markets not liking a lack of international leadership. And let me ask perhaps Hervé about this. What vulnerabilities in the systems of global cooperation has the virus shown up? Where are we seeing international leadership from heads of government? If we're not really getting it from President Trump, where are we getting it from? I mean, people are talking about Chancellor Merkel's truth-telling, but it does seem to me like it doesn't really feel like there are many big international leaders who are stepping up in an impressive way and everybody's sort of pivoting towards them. What do you think?
Yeah, I think even to the extent where we have seen leaders do the right thing, Merkel in Germany, I don't think it's really being broadcast globally. I don't think she means to be a global leader on this issue. She has enough issues at home. So it's a bit like what Alex was saying, it's what we're seeing when it comes to climate change as well. We're seeing private sector initiatives, we're seeing individual initiatives by businesses, we're seeing the likes of Google being more concerned than the White House about trying to stop this virus by advocating that its workers stay home. And so basically the government here is absent, at least at the international level. Now, I think credit is due to the World Health Organization. It's an embattled organization. It's come up for a lot of criticism. But without the WHO, we would be in a far worse position. I think the Director General, Tedros, really deserves credit here. But it's only as strong as its member states are competent. And sadly, what we've seen is that neither China nor the United States has been particularly exemplary here. In fact, they've both been very unappealing in different ways. I think what this shows is that the virus has been treated as a geopolitical football between China and the United States. It shows the limits of nativism. We had in the initial reaction to this virus a series of travel bans. Now that's easy to do if you're a populist, because again, it suggests that the source of the problem is coming from outside and that the solution is to build a strong fortress. But when the problem is coming from inside, or when you have to acknowledge it's a shared challenge, that's where we fall short. And I think that's increasingly apparent here.
Alex, because of this phenomenon where private institutions are ahead of the government and the government seems to be lagging, is there a gap opening up in public trust of governments and leaders as opposed to other institutions?
Yes, well, this is a phenomenon that most Western democracies have observed or experiencing for most of the last century, actually, and that is that trust in government is falling and is now at an all-time low. And, you know, most trusted surveys around the world show that it's now at its lowest point, at least until after the Second World War. For example, after the last Australian election, the Australian election study that said only 25% of people said that government could be trusted, 75% of people said that people in government look after themselves. In relation to the domestic situation and our own government, that actually suggests that there's an opportunity here for the Morrison government. You know, there was a mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, who said a while ago, never let a good crisis go to waste. President George Bush discovered this when his standing increased dramatically in the early weeks after the 9/11 crisis, when confidence in him went up from about 50% to about 90% in 2 weeks. Quite dramatic. As we know, the Morrison government was struggling through the bushfire crisis and after the Hawaii visit, you know, for various reasons. And there is now an opportunity to get that sort of bump from the way that the government responds to this crisis. So the health response, the stimulus package that Roland and Hova have been talking about, here is an opportunity for the government to start restoring that level of public trust in government to actually manage these sort of crises. It'll be interesting to see.
Well, and I might finish on this point, the Australian government response, and let me give each of you an opportunity to assess how you would rate the government, the Prime Minister's performance or the government's performance in the last few weeks. Of course, we had an address to the nation by the PM this week coming off the back of these two big statements. I'll start with you, Roland, and I'll finish with Alex. How would you assess the Australian response, Roland?
Yeah, I think broadly it's actually been pretty good. I'm going to focus on, you know, the stimulus package that was just announced. You know, I think one thing that's good is that the Morrison government basically dropped their obsession with getting back to budget surplus as quickly as possible, and they are going with a stimulus. They acknowledge it's going to push back their ability to hit a surplus, and they are even including cash handouts within the stimulus package as well, which is something that they were probably leaning against for political reasons earlier. Now they've switched to increasing it. In terms of the contents of that stimulus package, I mean, it's sizable, nearly 1% of GDP. That's good. It's front-loaded, so it's going to kick in when it's needed. That's also very good. And it mixes cash transfers to households in a fairly targeted way to the more vulnerable parts of the population, but also support to businesses. And most importantly, Morrison has said that it will be scalable based on what happens. And I think this is the key thing here, is that then this is the problem for him, is that he's basically set the goal as avoiding a recession, but this is, to an extent, largely out of his hands. It really turns on what happens with the virus outbreak here in Australia and what the most effective public health response will be. And quite possibly, if the outbreak does escalate and it requires a more stringent public health response, that is going to blunt the ability of stimulus to offset that and therefore the ability to avoid a recession.
Hervé, what do you think? How are we going?
I think the government's reaction initially was very muscular. We saw these travel bans instituted on travellers from China. But since then, I would characterise it as being too complacent. I think that we've clearly now entered a new tipping point where we're going to be seeing more community-level transmissions. And if there's a lesson to be learned internationally, it's the fact that we can learn from both the competency and the incompetency of China. So I read a statistic earlier today. China had about 120,000 cases of the coronavirus by the end of February 2020. That would have been 95%. Those cases would have been reduced by 95% had the measures that they brought in eventually been brought in 3 weeks earlier, had they not covered up the coronavirus. So what that suggests to me is that, yes, the measures work, but you really have to own up to the challenge very early on and before you even see the manifestations of an epidemic. And I think Australia has the privilege of learning from other countries, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, now Europe and Italy as well, both from the mistakes and the things that have gone right. And what it suggests to me is that we really need to be doing much more social distancing, early hygiene interventions, early mitigation measures before the worst hits us. And that's now. And when I read, or when I rather heard the Prime Minister yesterday say that he'll be attending the footy over the weekend, I think that's exactly the wrong sort of complacency. I think we need to be more measured, but we need to be acting sooner. And if we do act sooner, we can be more optimistic as well that we can have a handle over this thing.
Alex, I'll give you the final word. We are seeing leaders react to it in different ways. We saw Mr. Rutte, the Dutch Prime Minister, for example, whom the Institute hosted a few months ago, announced that there was a no-handshaking policy in the Netherlands. The Australian PM's message, I think, has been more one of keep calm and carry on, is how I would characterise it. How would you rate the Australian government's response to date?
If I can be permitted to give it a score, I'd put it at about a 7 or 8 out of 10. I'm reasonably impressed, actually. It's a sort of, as you say, it projects a calm but in control response. I know that there have been criticisms around the edges. Bill Boitel, who was a former Lowy Institute researcher, who's very experienced in managing viral crises, was critical of the public communications and the public advice that was being given that was so effective in through the HIV crisis. So there are those criticisms at the side, and Hervé's mentioned those as well. But I think generally, I think the government is projecting a calm and gathered response. I think there's a health aspect, there's an economic aspect, but I think also more importantly, there's that sense of calm, confident and in control, which is very important, I think, in managing a country through a crisis.
Well, thank you all. Thank you, Alex, Oliver, Hervé Lemahieu and Roland Raja for joining me in today's discussion. I think it was calm, confident, in control and measured. So we're modelling the kind of behaviour we want to see. Thank you for your analysis. COVIDcast is a limited edition weekly podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleagues, Maddie Neist, Erin Bassett and Selena Alvaro for their assistance. Make sure to tune in next week for the next episode of COVIDcast. Thank you.